All right. It's a download here on 720 WGN. It's time to reload this week's news. I'm excited about this. We've got the winners and losers, the biggest stories, the overreported, the underreported, which stories sucked us down the rabbit hole, and of course, which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 50, 100 years, 500 years from tonight or this week. Joining me in studio, two download regulars and two of my favorite people, Lee Bay. Lee, how are you? Good to see you.
Good to see you,
Lee, a longtime architecture critic here in Chicago, as well as a former columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Carol Felsenthal, good to see you, Carol. Thanks for being here. Carol is a political columnist for the Chicago Magazine, also does some stuff for Politico as well. Great to see you. Thanks for being here.
That's true. Thank you for inviting me.
All right. So we're ready to reload this week's news. I guess we started at the top with the biggest story of the week. Wowzers. All three of us, the story of James Comey and the continuing investigation surrounding Russia. I mean, what can we add to the story that the D.C. the D.C. political reporters aren't? I mean, they are just on it. Every hour, it seems like there's a new wrinkle to the story, a new source. Right. I mean, this is a weird time for American politics.
And as we get to the evening every night, there is a new revelation. Tonight's revelation is that Trump told the Russian ambassador and the Russian foreign minister that Comey was a nut job and that getting rid of him would take the pressure off of Trump, which is exactly what this new special counsel, one of the things that he's investigating, and of course the House and Senate are supposedly investigating too. So each layer of lunacy keeps the story going while Trump's on Air Force One going to, where's he going, it's, for Saudi
yeah,
Arabia?
Yeah, for Saudi Arabia, which is a story in itself as well. But Lee, I mean, what's your take on this? I mean, we've talked a lot about news and politics and, you know, in our careers, and this is something that it's such a head-scratcher to me. Donald Trump and his administration says it's a witch hunt. The media and the Democrats say, no, you've obstructed justice. You know, and now we're starting to see trends where the words like impeachment are coming up. I mean, what is happening?
You know, it is clearly, you know, fascinating beyond, you know, a guy my age, I'm 51, 52 this year. You know, Watergate was a thing when I was a kid, obviously, and the thing my parents made me watch. I think in the end, this could eclipse that in terms of the, my God, where are we? You know, in 20 years from now, when we'll have these documentaries on television, these pop culture documentaries about what marks this decade. This is going to be the thing that does it. But the thing about it is, at least with Nixon, it was a surprise, right? When you elect a reality show type to be president of the United States, this is what you get. And there's nothing in Trump's past that would lead you to believe he would be anything else other than what he is now. And I think that it's our American belief in a happy ending. You know, the guy goes to Washington and makes a change. The soccer mom becomes president of the city council and makes change. That I think he was able to pushed him in on, in addition to all other stuff that we can talk about from another show.
Right.
But we can't be surprised that this is where he's leading us. I'm only surprised it happened this quickly.
Are you surprised, Carol? I mean, what's happening?
I think there are two I words. There's impeachment, which is a mistake, I believe, to be predicting that, to be making people think that this is going to be something that's going to happen within the month. For one thing, the special counsel, Robert Mueller?
Yeah.
He could be working on this for 2 to 3 years. At the least, he's going to be going on this for a year
at least
or
a year,
year
right?
and a half.
October.
The other I word, indictment. Well, there may be Mike Flynn will be indicted. But I think that we should not underestimate Trump and his ability to come back and his ability to create such chaos that one cannot process one piece of chaos before the next piece hits. And I think that we also, political reporters made a terrible mistake in underestimating the support for Trump outside in the country and how much people despise the big newspapers, the Washington Post and the New York Times. They've been at the top
of
this story.
Chris Roebling is in here on Monday talking about this as the Washington Post wants to take the president down and it's all about egos. I don't know. I get that concept, but I also at the same time, if we're talking about, I mean, when you're straight ahead, you hear the president say, or it's reported and sources are leaking, and that might be what people are angry about. But the concept of, you know, the FBI director's a nut job. He's, I mean, he's talking to the Russians. It's the nut job. I had to get rid of him to ease this investigation. I mean, that sounds a lot like obstruction of justice, but I didn't hear the tone in which he was talking about.
Well, it sounds a little bit like LBJ, too. It's not like this is the first president. I mean, you know, I don't want to get too graphic about this, but LBJ used to have congressmen accompanying him to the toilet, and he used that as a way to humiliate Trump, as far as we know, has not carried humility. I mean, Trump is all about appearance anyway, so that wouldn't be his thing.
Right.
But we had Richard Nixon talking to portraits of his predecessors on the wall of the White House being drunk. Mm. One thing about Trump, could you imagine if Trump were a drinker, what that would be like? Because, you know, his brother died an alcoholic, and Trump does not drink at all. But he's not sober. He seems crazy, but his people, for example, Congresswoman Maxine Waters, who has turned into a heroine, especially the left, she's been calling for indictment before he took the oath of office. And I think while she's a kind of a folk hero to some, to others, she's everything that's wrong.
Well, I mean, once again, here we go down the partisan road, because we heard Republicans saying if Hillary Clinton wins, we're gonna impeach her before she starts. You hear Democrats on the, you know, saying, well, you know, we should indict President Trump before he even gets in the office. All the things about his conflicts of interest. I mean, this was, as you said, Lee, it's surprise. Maybe it's the surprise that it happened this quick. But I mean, it has this feel of an inevitable showdown that was just bubbling and bubbling and bubbling. And yeah, I don't know necessarily how it's going to end here.
Yeah, you know, and none of us do. But you know, it makes the belly swim, though, in a way. I mean, here's a person who, you know, who is complaining about being crucified, but yet nails himself to the cross, right? I mean, it's like some of this stuff is of his own making. And the Russian thing is just amazing. I mean, even if. And again, Comey, you're absolutely right, Carol. I mean, Comey's got a—I mean, you look how long the Nixon investigation didn't take like a week and a half. I mean,
it took a while,
and his teams of people, you know, combing through this. But still, I mean, he's his own worst enemy, I think, in this regard. But then again, but I'll agree. I mean, there is a crazy method to it, because he's able to shovel so much of it into this town square that you can't really,
right?
You know,
but what was the deal with the tweet? Jim Comey better, or James Comey, I think he called him, better be careful.
Yeah.
There may be tapes. And did he not live through Watergate? This guy's 70 years old. He was an adult during Watergate. Does he not remember the tapes? Now those will be subpoenaed.
Exactly.
One little detail that's interesting to mention is, President Obama taped in the Oval Office, and it's not something that's talked about very much, but there was a great anecdote that I read. A man who was writing a book about the capture and the death, the assassination of Osama bin Laden, goes to the Oval Office to interview President Obama, and he has this little digital tape recorder, what I used to do interviews, and what has happened to us all probably one time or another. You're leaving the Oval Office, and you realize your recorder wasn't working. Well, he was devastated. Here he is. He can't tell Obama that he was such a fool that his tape didn't work. So he's on his way out with this guy, Rhodes, who was a foreign policy advisor to President Obama and the guy behind the Iran deal. And Rhodes says to him, oh, don't worry, we tape. And before he leaves the White House, he has a printout. I think it was a printout.
A transcript,
interview,
well,
so you're safe.
Let me ask that question, because I will play devil's advocate as well. I mean, is Donald Trump being held to a different standard? As he says, he's the most unfairly treated president. But, I mean, we have had presidents in the past. You mentioned LBJ, Nixon. I mean, we just heard
Kennedy
about Obama.
Would appreciate the fact that he got treated a little bit worse.
True, of course. But the idea that, you know, the establishment in the White House is using a lot of the things that politicians do that the public doesn't know about to sort of rake Donald Trump over the coals. I mean, Donald Trump, in a certain way, like whether it be tapes or whether it be, you know, what classified information and telling the Russians. I mean, that's stuff that a lot of politicians and presidents have done. Why is it different than Donald Trump?
You know, it's the through line through all that makes things a little bit suspect, right? I mean, you know, you know, and it's the same characters. It's always Russia. It's never Italy. It's never Portugal, right? You know, it all comes back to Russia. I think that again, he gets himself into trouble. I mean, he raises the specter of tapes, himself.
Right.
And I mean, it's just, you know, I think that's the case. I mean, I think that people, you know, I think also that, you know, when you come into office a certain way, that tends to be the way that you're judged. I mean, Obama comes in, there's no drama Obama. Had there been drama on his watch, even if it was not as bad as Nixon and maybe less than Clinton, he would have had to walk the plank for that in some respect. He would have to answer to that. I think when you come in slinging mud and making accusations, as this president did,
yeah,
this is the thing you're going to judge
by. He's not making friends.
And so much, you know, talk about no drama Obama, which is absolutely true. I think Obama is more and more admired. You just look at him now. You love the slimness and the coolness of this guy. And you say, where is he? Mm-hmm. But then you have these dramatic effects like Mike Flynn at the DNC convention saying, lock her up,
the RNC,
lock
yeah,
her
right,
up.
Right,
and you
right,
can't,
right.
The irony of
that's,
it.
Exactly. There's a delicious irony to all everything that's happening in this weird, weird story that continues to be, I mean, contrast, contradictions, juxtaposition.
And if he could govern, Americans would overlook it. If he could govern the country, Americans could at some point overlook it. But I think you can't have this and not be able to govern. And you just, you know, here in Chicago, I mean, we, as you know, we put up with a lot of things over the decades you and I have been around, the three of us have been around. But when a city can be well governed, and as it was during some times in there, you're kind of willing, is my garbage getting picked up? You know,
right.
Is it,
that's the old
know,
adage,
the,
right.
The taxes aren't taking too big of a bite out of me. I'm mad about it. But if you can't govern, and you got this drama around you,
and you don't read briefing papers because you have the attention span of an insect. You don't read briefing papers. You don't take the personal intelligent briefs. And what I hear, Trump doesn't get that. He can't keep ideas in his mind, and he has no knowledge. He has no base of knowledge that probably your son has a bigger base of knowledge.
maybe, if you put a screen in front of him.
My son does.
Carol Felsenthal, Lee Bay, we're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do overreported and underreported. It's the download. Stay with us. Reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200, the phone number. All right, let's do winners and losers, because, you know, I want to do overreported and underreported as well, but overreported is kind of, you know, talk about male fashion. So let's talk about winners, because, Carol, you have a list of winners that are not unlike what we were just talking about, the Russian investigation, but say the number one winner.
Right, the number one is Jim Comey. And he's number one because he was everybody's evil man of the week. He had that, you know, that weird look. He's got those big bags under his eyes. He looks like he never sleeps. And after, on October 28th, what was that, a week before the election, about, or a little more, 10 days maybe, he comes out and he says, we're reopening the Hillary Clinton email. It seemed like he just had it in for her and he was going to do her in, and Democrats were as angry as could be. And then Trump comes up with this, kind of, you have to wonder how he thinks. He said, I thought this would be a popular decision. The way he put it, it would be a bipartisan decision because the Democrats hated him so much, and that firing him
you're absolutely right.
Would be popular. Yeah. So I'd say Jim Comey, who went from being a dog to being, a hero FBI agent, straight.
It's so true. Like, everyone's like, oh, dude, a free Comey. Like, that's what we're getting right now. This is ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, you're right. We go to optics, but it's Trump would have fired him right away.
When he came to testify before Congress and he made that blooper, this is like a week or 10 days ago, and he said there were hundreds of thousands of Hillary emails, and he said it with such conviction and such kind of a steely gaze, and he was completely wrong. There weren't hundreds of thousands. There were maybe 400 or something. I mean, there were some, but not all those.
Yeah, they made it seem like it was a huge,
He was hyperbolic. And it was not, it wasn't the kind of thing that you would expect for somebody under oath before. I don't know whether he was under oath.
Lee, what do you got for winners?
For winners, you know, I'm thinking a little bit more local. I think the North Side becomes a
love
winner.
Love this story.
For the North Branch Industrial Corridor Framework Plan. Wonky as it sounds, but it's a framework plan to redevelop guidelines, city guidelines to redevelop the riverfront from about Kinzie, around Kinzie to somewhere around Fullerton. Why that's important is because, you know, this will shape the city for the next 50 to 100 years. It's probably one of the first times in the city of urban planning, right? One of the first large-scale examples of true urban planning that the city has done. But again, the spoils go north of Madison once again. So I don't want to say the South Side is losing, but again, the North Side comes up with...
Well, you can make an argument. I mean, you have a tremendous couple of years here in urban planning and development, whether it be the Obama Center on the South Side or the redevelopment of the North Branch of the Chicago River. Obviously, the redevelopment of the North Branch of Chicago River is going to be a huge deal, just in property values alone. I mean, it's funny when you look at the aerial, what they want to do is amazing when you look at the report. But when you look at the aerial space now along the river, it really does paint a picture of a bygone era.
Yeah.
The going up Goose Island, you're like, those are all, you just see it. Like, you see all around it development, a different type of city, and then a city from the 70s, or something that's right in the middle of the heart of the North Side of Chicago.
You know, it is, and changing fast. And what it's doing is, and again, you know, when I say the North Side is winning again, I'm a little rueful about that in a way, because, you know, what you're seeing is between 24th Street to the south, Fullerton to the north, and the lake to Ashland to Western, this city within a city, which is very wealthy and increasingly with increasing wealth, increasing density, increasing jobs, those kind of things. And, you know, what happens to what's happening on the margin, south of that, west of that, and somewhat north of that. But for now, I would say, and I'm hoping that what comes out of this is that is good ideas that can be transported to other parts of the city. South Branch, right? The South Side has a southwest side has a branch, Calumet River to the further south. So I'm hoping that something can happen there other than just merely development.
I do remember this. I remember when breaking down the numbers of who voted for Mayor Rahm Emanuel in the mayoral election. If you go right up the gut of the north side of Chicago through the North Branch and all those neighborhoods, that's where he grew. That's where he drew his strength.
Oh yeah,
his strength, but he's got to run again in 2019.
Yeah, well, he's taking care of his crew there. I mean, the other one I want to say winners on top of it is also, I don't want to say losers yet because it's, you know, it's all speculation, but. Mm-hmm. The development company Sterling Bay, a company that
relation to me.
No relation, of course. They are a development company. They have been the ones gobbling up the land along the river, whether it be Finkel and Son Steel or the tannery there. And just this week, scrap metal place that's cashing out. You get this idea that it's a progressive thought and we're moving forward, yet you have this thing lurking in the back, which is the old Chicago way, where this development company is. I mean, they said it in Cranes. It was in the piece where, like, we bought up all this land on a hunch that someday it might be redeveloped. I'm like, really? You're putting hundreds of million dollars in on a hunch?
But, you know, I'm inclined to think that's the case. I mean, if they buy it.
Because they laxed the zoning this week. This is the week that the city council said, all right, we're going to change the zoning.
That's true. But
who wins on that?
Well they
Sterling
do. But it doesn't take it takes a rich person, a rich entity. It doesn't take a necessarily smart entity to know that's where development is going to happen in Chicago, and that's where a mayor is more likely, if you buy property there, to sort of decide things in your favor. If Sterling Bay buys property at 67th and Racine, and then and it turns out to be rich and gets rich off that, then I'll say, these guys are doing something.
That's the Chicago way.
All of a sudden, right?
Right. But Goose Island, it's just a good business.
Exactly. Yeah, and a pretty obvious one.
I trust you on
mix.
That. Yeah. Okay. What else do we got? I mean, those are my winners. You know, I also had, you know, talk about Springfield. I feel like J.B. Pritzker, even though this week you could put him in winners or losers, mm-hmm. and we'll talk about
it. I put him in the losers because I thought that story, that great
we'll
reporter for the Sun-Times.
A very interesting story, and I wonder if it sticks, and I guess that's my point. But
it's going to be in every commercial that you could imagine about how he
property
saves money and how he refurbishes the outside of the house so that his house looks like it's next to another nice house, but inside he's got all the toilets ripped out and he gets this deal on his taxes. I thought it sounded terrible. And I think that all of this money being thrown around by Ken Griffin in Rauner's hands.
Maybe I say Bruce Rauner's a winner. In fact, he got $20 million from Ken Griffin this week.
Yeah, but he and Pritzker, and then in the lower, the tier just below Kennedy, but it makes those other two guys, Daniel Biss, and Amaya Paywar, sound like there's just a kind of an earnestness to those two guys that is very appealing, and they're running against this money in politics.
Yeah.
And what do we need to know that we don't know after these couple of years of Bruce Rauner?
Right. Well, let's do this. Mm-hmm. Lee Bay, Carol Felsenthal, my guests tonight as we reload the news, 312-981-7200. We'll do this. We'll come back and we'll talk more about Springfield. And we'll talk about the losers of the week. That's a segment coming up after Rob's news, which is right now, here on 720 WGN, which is... Thanks, Rob. So download here on 720 WGN. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Carol Felsenthal, Chicago Magazine, political columnist, as well as a writer for Politico. You still doing that?
I'm doing, yeah, The Hill.
The Hill,
The Hill also, that's, The Hill is
great.
Yeah,
I like The Hill, yeah.
They've been having a lot of scoops.
I was going to say, The Hill is a winner, I would say, on this story for Trump, because I see The Hill every single day. I find myself reading The Hill.
Well, the thing about The Hill that's interesting is that it seems, it has a kind of a bipartisan flavor to it. I've been reading The Washington Post. I used to get it in the mail, in my mailbox with all the grocery ads. I love The Washington Post. But you look at The Washington Post online now, and every story, both in politics, front page, opinion, is Trump is awful, Trump is awful, yeah. Trump's got to go. It's just, and after a while, no matter how you feel about Trump, you feel like there's some kind of overload. So you get to a website like The Hill, and it's a little bit of a relief because they attempt to at least try to be a little more complex.
Well, you know, I hate to say it, but I mean, they follow the clicks in some way. Yeah. And the Washington Post is doubling down on the idea that people are clicking through. It's New York Times probably too. They've had really great seasons for newspapers and websites.
You look at the comments on some of those Washington Post stories, and they are in the high, thousands, way, way up there. Hmm. So people are reading the Post, and people who read the Post don't like Donald Trump, so they're playing to their audience.
Right.
But that's not what a newspaper is supposed to do.
Yeah, agreed. Lee Bay also in studio, a former Chicago Sun-Times, former everything. Yes. Former everything. That's Lee Bay is here. We'll just stop right there. Right. All right, so let's do this. Let's talk about the losers. We talked about the winners coming up. Losers, you both got laundry lists of losers.
I'll give you my list and just give you a little. Rod Rosenstein, mm-hmm. who was considered to be a great Justice Department guy, and then he goes and he writes that memo, which looks like he's doing Donald Trump's dirty work, and now he's in big trouble, and nobody seems to respect him anymore. Mike Pence, caught in a couple of lies.
Disappeared. He's not really been in it. Yeah.
Well, but he was caught in a couple of big bloopers, and that seems to have taken him off the Boy Scout route. H.R. McMaster, another one, National Security Board, really respected guy. He goes out and does that press conference defending Trump.
Yeah.
It didn't seem right. Joe Lieberman, now there's another one where Trump said he's going to be my FBI guy and he's going to get 100 votes in the Senate. Trump must never have really read anything other than the New York Post because he doesn't understand that Democrats don't like Joe Lieberman. First of all, he's an independent. Second of
he
was a McCain supporter. Spicer, of course, Mike Flynn, Paul Ryan.
You get the whole thing.
All Republicans. Ivanka, whose book has been reviewed in some of the harshest terms I've ever seen, and it's not even doing well. Mm-hmm. And this other guy, and then I'm going to give this up, but the other one is David Garrow, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of Martin Luther King, and he writes what I think is in some ways a really fascinating book about Obama, digs up this old girlfriend, making it look like he married Michelle for a political reason. His book is getting nasty reviews and not doing well either.
Wow.
So I'll stop.
There you go, Carol.
That's a good list.
Go.
Excellent list.
All right. Well, let's go local. I mean, because I like the one you have, Lee, and this is one that really hits home for all of us, really, is the you have the Chicago Sun-Times. Times. A big media story this week.
You know, I do. And of course, many of you know that Chicago Sun-Times is my former home. I spent 10 years there back in the 90s and early 2000s. And it's, you know, it's under the hand of, soon to be perhaps under the hand of Trunk. That's funny. I can't quite say the name. the former Tribune Media Company, and it will place both papers under single ownership. Mm-hmm. One can help but wonder. What that does to the Sun-Times future. I mean, it certainly saves it in the short run, but you wonder what happens in the in the future. And if it remains a two-paper town, you know, you're always going to have one that'll be above, that'll be, you know, more capitalized than the other. I would wish, you know, we talked about the Washington Post. I would wish, you know, the guy who owns Amazon could have stepped in, someone else could have stepped in to give the paper the capital.
Chicago, Chicago has a long-standing pride on the fact that this is a two newspaper town. There are a lot of towns we've seen that have dissolved, brought them together. I think of Detroit, maybe Philadelphia,
Houston,
Cincinnati. I mean, this is a trend that's not abnormal. Mm-hmm. But Chicago, for whatever reason, and it might just be because of the politics, the perceived politics behind the editorials on both sides. One was more conservative, and one was more liberal. One was more suburban. One was more city. But there seemed to be this great sort of yin and yang between the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times. And I think that maybe that you're seeing right now is when people see that one's going to buy the other, there is this sort of shed a tear mentality.
It really is. I mean, you know, two papers that were competitive. I mean, I remember even before architecture, certainly with architecture, even before architecture, you know, you wanted to beat the other guy, beat the other paper. And, you know, and the voices were different. And of course, they were founded, you know, one founded, you know, to stress conservative ideals, one founded and put together and founded after the war as kind of a paper for FDR and that. I mean, and it's a great history that I think is at risk. And yet, you know, Chicago is still two cities, right? I mean, part of the reason for that, for what you've discussed and the sort of summation of why we're supporting two papers is because Chicago really is two cities in one. And I think that, more than two cities, actually. And I think that having those two separate voices would be a good thing, but it's tough.
Let's say, I mean, Carrie, you've been, you know, you full disclosure, I mean, you write for a publication that's owned by Trunk, right?
Right, right. Somebody said that the word Trunk, which you didn't want to say, you said it sounds like something that an angry caveman would say. And I thought that was pretty good because it's so weird.
It's weird.
I think your idea about Jeff Bezos, that would be, you know, why? Somebody ought to call that guy, because when the Grahams sold, Don Graham, Kay Graham's son, sold to him, everybody thought, oh, this is the end of fine journalism. All he's done is brought readers to that paper and resources. They're hiring at the Washington Post. Let's get Bezos in here. And
well, I mean,
Amazon is putting a lot of money into the state. That's a great idea.
Say what you will about the Tribune and Michael Farrow and Trunk, but he is a local businessman. He's not somebody who's coming in from somewhere. He's not a huge. They're not a huge corporation in the sense that they're, you know, just buying up a nondescript gobble gobble in the city. I mean, the Tribune, he used to own the Sun-Times, and now he's moving place. I mean, what about the concept that you know, when you talk to anyone at Trunk, they say, well, we're interested in the paper, and we're not necessarily interested in making it one. Like, we want to make it two, and they'd be independent. Do you buy that kind of thing? Do you think that maybe there is a life to the idea that there could be two separate media entities in Chicago owned by the same person?
But what kind of life, I guess? I mean, is it a life in which Jenny McCarthy is a columnist? And that's the columnist of our generation, not another Mike Royko, not another Vernon Jarrett, that kind of thing. So, yeah, you know, it's like, I remember, it's like the Bullwinkle cartoon, right, that I saw when I was a kid that cracked me up, and Boris falls out of the plane and hits the ground, and Natasha runs over and says, Boris, you are living. And he's like all wrecked, and he says, this is living? And that's how I feel about the paper. I mean, I wish it could be in better hands.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well,
and we haven't mentioned The Reader.
Yeah, and that was last week's story,
on The Reader here in Chicago, and that, it seems to be in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. And my buddy Mike Miner just retired.
That's a big story. Mm-hmm. And you know, last week Kevin Warwick was on. He was here for he reloaded with us, and he's the associate editor at the Trib or at the Reader. And we talked about that they posted their salaries. They put their salaries
That's right.
A piece of paper on the window, and that picture went viral and showed how little money the Reader staffers, longtime staffers, you know, highly sought after positions were getting paid. And it makes you really sort of understand a little bit more about why the Chicago Reader has been really kind of making a move to get the Sun-Times to first to unionize, mm-hmm. and then to say, listen, we need a living wage. So, I mean, there's a lot of trouble over there, and maybe Michael Farrow comes in and fixes
it. But I hate for it to lose its independent voice. You know, there's one paper to the left, perhaps, one paper to the right, and then there's one that kind of does its own thing. And I think that vibrant cities need that kind of funky paper that can take on police brutality and corruption in ways that neither paper has done over the past 25 years. The work that John Conroy did, exposing the horrors of Area 2 years ago. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that you wonder will be at risk under one ownership. Not that anyone's necessarily suppressing it, but, you know, one man, one vision. You can only think of so many things that and the guy who wants to play with the bicycle that he bought, you know, you wonder if there's an appetite for that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, the Sun-Times editorial page was conservative for a while. And then remember when they stopped endorsing candidates?
Yeah.
And then they started.
They came out of retirement for Rauner.
Now there's a real distinction between those two editorial pages. The Tribune editorial page is quite conservative mm-hmm. now, mm-hmm. especially on economic issues. And the Sun-Times is quite liberal. The Tribune has an interesting editorial I read before I came here, which is negative on Lisa Madigan.
Incomplete, and that's what they said.
Right, yeah. Right. And I thought it was an interesting editorial, mm-hmm. but it goes along with and it's the Tribune is a supporter of Bruce Rauner. I mean, there's no other way to look at it.
Okay, so let's before we wrap up on losers, the other loser is I'm not even going to say his name because I'm not, but the gentleman who was caught on tape punching a security guard, a female security guard, in the Gold Coast or the downtown area here after a night clubbing that was, like I said, was caught on tape and, you know, just widely mm-hmm. Spread across the country, became a viral hit of mm-hmm. watching this crude experience of a security guard coming out and saying, you got to go, and this guy getting violent. Not a good week for that guy, and not a good week for Chicago. I mean, I guess in a good way, it was great to watch Chicago get mad. It was almost like this guy punched Chicago. You know, you really can't do that.
You know, I agree, but I think that the designation is thematic. It goes to him and the women who are with him. One of whom was his wife, and the guy that was with him too. Because, you know, the thing about it is, you watch the tape and you think, if this guy. You would think that someone would say, my God, what are you doing, and pull him away or express some shock. But they look, he delivers a punch, they're looking at him, three of them are at least, and they just sort of go on about their way. Yeah. So I think that the hat of shame needs to be worn by all of them. He's remorseful now, but one can't help but wonder if he's remorseful that he got caught, and more than he is remorseful over having done it. And looking at the tape again, it doesn't make any sense. The woman was trying to render some aid at some point and has to clean up the mess that he's made, and she has to suffer the indignity. But you're right. It was good to see Chicagoans mad at this. And, you know, obviously, you know, she's African-American. He isn't. And in this time we live in, when people are so polarized by issues of race, to see everyone sort of admit that this was wrong.
Yeah.
And this is not good. It was one silverish lining, I guess.
Lee Bay, Carol Felsenthal in studio. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and let's start our overreported and underreported, because we got a lot to do through that. Then we've got Rabbit Hole, and then we've got what story is going to be remembered from this week when it comes to history. So download. Stay with us. Yeah, it's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Carol Felsenthal, Lee Bay in studio. We are reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Let's go for overreported and, of course, underreported. Overreported, I mean, the story, we'll just kind of gloss over the overreported. The story I thought was overreported was the male rompers. This was the romper is the piece of fashion, and a company raised tons of money to take the female fashion and make it male fashion. And everyone thought it was crazy. And that's where we're at. That's it. That's the overreported story, right? And also the millionaire saying avocado toast. That the other one where I'm like, what is happening here?
But the way that was reported that I found so irritating is that the guy who was writing about it mostly managed to link it to the irresponsibility of millennials
yeah, right.
who can't buy a house because they're buying avocado toast. Although I must say, I go to New York a lot. My children live there. And in Brooklyn, my health-conscious daughter eats this stuff all the time, and I pay for it. And it is about, you know, it can cost like $15 to have toast with smashed avocado and a little red pepper on it.
But well, that's a good. Well, you're a good mom for picking that up.
You know, but it's funny. I mean, but to link it that, you know, the people this age, and I have two daughters this age, have been handed a crummy economy, crummy job prospects, crummy salaries, and avocado toast. Is the reason why it reminds me of people who complain about people buying expensive gym shoes. And it's like, well, you know, maybe it's not the wisest thing to do, but that isn't the reason why why people are poor.
I also feel like the idea of a millionaire kind of spouting off about why, you know, pick yourself up. You know, if you would do this, you know, I feel like it's a stereotype too. And I know a lot of millennials who are probably doing a lot better than us in this room that are doing fine with understanding how they're going to live their lives.
Exactly.
Yet for some reason, it's always been that the generations above look down on the generations below. And it's just added to that fuel.
That's true. When I was young, right. You know, Generation X, you're a slacker. You're not doing anything.
Right.
It's like, I got two jobs. What do you expect out of me? Right. What do you want from me?
But that whole theme started with Starbucks, and that's so ubiquitous. That you spending so much on coffee that you could make for pennies yourself if you happen to be in a place where you could make coffee.
Right. All right, let's go on to underreported. This is a much better part of the reload. Carol, what do you got for underreported?
Well, again, this is not politically correct, and many of my friends would probably disagree, but I think the leak aspect of this Russia story is being underreported. Mm. And when you see, like I did this afternoon, that there was somebody with access to sound or tapes or was eavesdropping or in the room who repeated. Now, this person is a Trump person, but there's leaks all over the place. And I do believe that a lot of the leaking is coming from the Obama people who were on his foreign policy team, especially. So I kind of agree with Donald Trump that it's not talked about enough.
Right.
And I just don't know how you manage to figure it out, since the people who work for Obama, not for Obama, for Trump, are panicking. They want out, so it's hard to kind of contain.
That's a hard story, and it's one that Donald Trump wants us to all pay attention to over the fact of the Russian investigation.
But it's really fascinating. If you go into Twitter, for instance, I mean, there are people like Claude Taylor and Louise Minch who report these things weeks in advance, and it turns out they're dead on.
Yeah.
And they got sources there that are enviable. But you're right. It's the leaks that are coming out, and they're leaking accurately, which is
accurately. And in such wonderful detail, and such great storytelling detail.
Yeah. they took their storytelling classes.
You know, as usual, foreign stories, international stories, I think are really underreported. Yeah. Underreported. What happened with the Turkey's president's thugs, and these people are exercising their First Amendment right to protest, and they just came and they hurt these people physically.
In our country.
On American soil.
In our country.
In D.C.
In our country with, what's his name, the President Erdogan.
Erdogan,
sitting in his car watching it. And the last thing I read was that he gave a hand signal to his guys suits and shiny
shoes. How do we let that happen? I mean, who's in charge of upholding that? Would it be the White House, or who would be the one to say,
I bet you Trump's
you
envious. Look what this guy can do.
But on our own country.
But I think what's really valiant, catch him at the little bit in the clip, is that the uniformed police force there, from I think these are Capitol Police, they broke it up, and some of those guys were delivering some pretty good whacks to the Turks who were doing the bad thing, and that's kind of underreported as well. But that kind of thing is an outrage, that's another show. But it's an outrage, and one can't help
this
but
week's
wonder.
Outrage.
That's right. One can't help but wonder if a president like the president of Turkey is emboldened to do this because of who sits in the White House.
And because he just met with him.
Exactly.
He just met with him. You know, who knows what Trump said?
Yeah.
You
know,
good going. Like the way you
the
run
Russians
your
know.
Country.
The Russians
let's,
know.
Let's imprison everybody and arrest newspaper editors.
Yeah. Carol Felsenthal, Lee Bay, we're going to continue with underreported after the news, because I want to get to your underreported story, which is very fascinating, Lee. Also, we'll get to rabbit hole stories and which story will be remembered. It's a download. We're reloading this week's news here on 720 WGN, 312-981-7200. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, 312-981-7200. We're gonna wrap this up by 9:30, but we got underreported, and then we're gonna get to the rabbit hole stories. Lee Bay, your underreported story of the week.
Fascinating story by the Daily Southtown newspaper out of Markham, in which Markham, the suburb of Markham, southern suburb of Markham, has had 17 strip club and nightclub related shootings over the past 7 years, and almost 10 of them were at one club. And, you know, basically it's the end of the night and everybody's wild and emotions are high and guns are out. And what's fascinating about this is that the town, if it isn't a cover-up, it's as close as you can possibly get. They don't want to respond to, inquiries about this. The neighbors can't figure out what to do. There are connected guys who are behind these clubs. And the fascinating thing, which is worth checking out, is the interview that the Southtown reporters did with the police chief of Markham. And he's saying in it, well, you know, yeah, there's shootings, but you got to keep in mind how many days these places are open. And so the shootings are relatively small compared to the 300 days of the year that these places are open. And then he tells reporters that, you know, he really wants to talk about, he wants to move on. He wants to talk about
positive
stories.
Right.
But people say, you know, in neighborhoods and suburbs like this, you go through them and you say, well, look how these people live. And shame on them for living this way. But increasingly, and this is a thread that runs through all of it, is that so-called ghettos are made. They're connected, and people, no matter what their race may be, who own these clubs, who are able to get the protection from the city that regular people cannot get. Compare that to the River North here, when there's shootings.
You're done.
And you're done here in Chicago.
If you get a shooting within the vicinity of a club, they're like, they got that orange sheet on there. Like,
yes,
yep,
they'll close you up. So, you know, so you see these struggling suburbs out there, and you think, well, how do they get this way? And what, you know, it always gets phrased like a question of morality or behavior of, you know, if they would pull their pants up, if they would do this. But these places are made by institutions that are far beyond and far richer than the people who
have
to suffer.
That's a good one. The Daily Southtown, check that out. Markham Strip Club, 17 shootings in 7 years.
Yeah.
Jeez. Carol, what do you have for, let's go talk about the stories that sucked us down the rabbit hole. This is a story that people, doesn't necessarily have to do with breaking news or anything like that, but what are the stories that really kind of grabbed your attention this week? What story are you talking
about? Well, I'm, you know, Washington focused as I am lately, you know, the rabbit hole story for me was, you know, that I live and breathe this stuff, and I have the bags under my eyes to show it. I'm up in the middle of the night reading, and I'm going to write something. I probably should just save it for that, but I have the sense that Trump's going to resign. And I think that because he resigns, he becomes a martyr. He does these rallies across the country. He's the most famous, most popular man in America. He can denigrate Washington and the establishment and all that, and he can do it. And he doesn't have to live in that crummy White House anymore that's too small for him. Go back, live in his mansion in Mar-a-Lago. He can go back and live in his penthouse in Manhattan in the Trump Tower. He can sleep in his own great bed every night. He can eat better crappy food. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't have to, the criticism, it must be just so painful to him. People are not going to make fun of his hair as much anymore, you know, now.
But I mean, I'll play devil's advocate only on the sense that this he has been in the public spotlight before he was even a reality star.
Right.
He was a billionaire, playboy, New York, front page of the New York Post all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a joke on Saturday Night Live. He's been through criticism.
He's been through criticism, but you watch that correspondence dinner where Obama made fun of him. Mm-hmm. You look at his face. That was in 2011.
Right.
That's when he decided to run for president. And I think that he doesn't, you know, being president is just too much damn work for him. He doesn't want to read the briefing papers. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to get his daily intelligence. He knows nothing about the issues. He makes such rookie mistakes that that's my theory, and I'm going to go with it.
I like it. All right.
Yeah,
we all like it.
All right, so let's let's go ahead and continue on the rabbit hole story. And let's go back to you, Lee. Yours, I mean, this story, it's surprising to me because I know that it's not underreported, but because of all of the news that came out this week and everything that's happening in Washington, the death of Roger Ailes was not as talked about. I mean, and maybe we'll see it this weekend with pieces about the ramification or what he did to Fox News and just sort of the idea of what he left behind, what his legacy was. But that's sort of your rabbit hole story.
I find it fascinating. I mean, of course, if you watch Fox News, they've all got purple bunting behind them when they're talking about him. But here's a guy who basically, to me, exploited. There's been a few postmortems about this and saying things like, you know, he led America astray. He did this, he did that. And all that is true. But he sold something that Americans wanted to buy. And that can't right. be lost. And it's the same thing that Goldwater sold. It's the same thing that George Wallace sold. It's the same thing that thousands of, kind of tin horn Rush Limbaugh wannabes across America selling, and people are buying it. He was smart enough to create a network out of it, for better or for worse. But I think that what he's done to the American media landscape, what he's done to the American psyche, I think is endlessly fascinating to me. But it can't not be said that if something bad came from that, then Americans were complicit in it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. He wasn't like the guy who came right. to town like and
there have been many of attempts. I mean, you think of there have been political talk shows, networks, radio networks, others that have failed. Fox News did not. And Roger Ailes, for if you agree with it or not, people wanted to watch it.
They do. And it's insidious because, you know, it starts off being sort of partisan and then it ratchets itself up to what if it isn't reporting falsehoods, it comes really close to doing
fair and balanced,
it.
Or can I,
that's right.
You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, on the day that Roger Ailes died, I watched Fox News because I wanted to see how they reported it. I have never seen so many tears shed by so many of the Fox News stars who mm-hmm. talked about Bret Baier. He didn't tear up, but he talked about when his son had open heart surgery, the first person who was there for him was Roger Ailes. I can't think of the guy's name. He's an older guy who came from, I think, ABC News. His son committed suicide, and he said Roger Ailes had a bad ankle. He traveled across the country to be at his side. Another woman was diagnosed with MS. Roger Ailes was... So you had that on the one end. On the other hand,
and
you have a guy
end,
who committed these sexual assaults that were disgusting. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it wasn't... But on Fox News, they were shedding tears.
Well, I mean, It is interesting, and I'm waiting for all the thought pieces to come out. I'm sure we'll see them this weekend. But the death of Roger Ailes, the last, I mean, for me, a rabbit hole story, which I think really interesting for Chicago, is the story that the FOP has a new president, mm-hmm. right, a union president, the Fraternal Order of Police, about the police. This week, Eddie Johnson, the superintendent, came out and said they're changing their excessive force policy. They've been working on this for a while, and he added something to it. And the FOP under a new leadership, Kevin Graham, I think it's Kevin Graham, they put out a statement that said, you know what? I mean, essentially this was about sanctity of life. Mm-hmm. That they said at last resort, they're changing the way excessive force, and they really wanted to prioritize the sanctity of life. And the FOP's response was, you know, they don't, no. A, we're not changing excessive force. The Department of Justice investigation to us and report is false. We don't believe it. It was political. We are not. He also mentioned that race is not an issue when it comes to Chicago police. He also mentioned that, and they mentioned in the piece about the idea that officers will do whatever it takes to protect themselves, and they don't have the sanctity of life is not a concern for them. And I don't mean that in a negative, you know, like the idea they didn't say that word for word, mm-hmm. but the concept of pushback from the union, pushback from the officers. The political climate has changed. They have Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump. It's a different Department of Justice. I mean, it's a different time, but essentially this idea that, you know what, everything that's happened from Laquan McDonald to now, erase it. We are doubling down that nothing has changed. It's what we're doing is right, and the Chicago police are not going to change because of politics.
You know, it's frightening, and it's kind of a false equivalency. No Chicagoan, no matter where they live, wants a police force to be in danger. right? Because if he's in danger and he has a gun, you know I'm definitely in danger, right? But I think that this but the pushback is then let us operate the way we want to operate. And there's no such thing as brutality when there is. I mean, it's clear that the communities are not policed equally, and that needs to be dealt with. So I think no one wants a police officer to be in danger. I've got a cousin who's a police officer. Certainly do not want her to be in danger. But I think there's a long way between that point and what you saw with Laquan McDonald and some of the things, my God, and the things we saw for 20 years at Area 2 out in the South Side through John Birch. And, you know, you can police these areas, you can make them safe, you can do all those things without shooting unarmed people, without beating people to pulps in police headquarters. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, is the issue.
And you heard in the Department of Justice, and I always bring this up because I feel like that sometimes it's a false equivalency, like you said, but I also feel like, you know, I want to get the story right. A lot of police officers in the Department of Justice report said, hey, they just are being, they want better training for the environment they are policing now.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning what's happening now with, I mean, you even see these terrible stories of semi-automatic weapons, military-style weapons with gang members. And I do believe the FOP is correct in saying they are they're emboldened with the right now. And they don't, and this idea that at a certain point, the training for police officers needs to be upgraded. They can't be showing clips from 1977. This is how you holster your gun, like that. You know what I mean? And that's what I think police officers want to say. If I'm trained correctly, I'm not going to make any mistake that can be politicized later.
Well, I totally agree. But if you walk in and live in these communities, they want the people who live in these communities want the gangbanger with assault weapons to be dealt with in a way. What they don't want is the case of the poor pastor from a couple of years ago. Channel 7 did a piece about this, who is coming down the street or coming down the alley and a cop is coming her way. And they can't get around each other. And the woman ends up getting insulted and beaten by the policeman. The woman wasn't committing a crime. It's those are the kind of things that people are complaining about.
Or the John Birch stuff.
And they get mushed together in ways that are wrong. They're just absolutely wrong.
I really want to get, and I think we're going to get the FOP president in, mostly because I truly want to know, you know, if they truly believe it's politicized. If police officers on the beats and the streets believe that nothing has changed and yet the politics of the country changed, meaning Obama and they're talking specifically about Obama and the idea of speaking for the victims, not for the police officers, that has been the trouble. And then now they believe with Trump and the
Sessions.
And Sessions that they have allies in Washington and people will that the climate will change once again.
You could not put two people together who are more different than Jeff Sessions and Eric Holder.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now, and if Pence should become president, it'll be more so because Pence is more socially conservative.
Sure is.
I think for me, the rabbit hole story and what I love about it, and I'm fascinated by it and I'm learning more and more about politics and police, is just this idea that the last year didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what the FOP and the police union is saying. Like, okay, everything that's happened in the last that we've been, I mean, from headlines to the Department of Justice reports to everything that has happened since Laquan McDonald's, that video came out. No, that's not happening. We're moving on to something else.
Criminal justice reform
right
today mm-hmm. is out the window. And Jeff Sessions wants more. Sessions wants a bigger penalties for people who are dealing in drugs. And then you have him and you compare him to somebody like Tony Preckwinkle, the president of the Cook County Board.
That's her issue. Interesting. Yeah.
And she's doing it. Everything is just
how local and national are going to play with each other. Right.
But you know, how many times have we seen this over the past 50 years where a thing, a law, a military device is created for the bad guy and it ends up, bear with me for a second. I catch Metro a lot, right? Mm-hmm. And I was getting on the Metro train, and this battle wagon rolls up, and these guys get out with uniforms on. They're going to the bathroom. So I said, I've never seen this before. What is this? And this is their
It looks like the Batmobile, right?
Yeah, well, it's like this big, giant van, you know, filled with guys in camouflage. And these are Metro police. So they get this because, you know, they're going to protect us from terrorists. When it's 2002, the terrorists more than likely are not going to be on the Metro Electric line, getting on at Hyde Park and doing anything. So who is this device going to be used for? the guy who doesn't pay his Metro fare, the guy who's, you know, doing that kind of thing. So what I'm saying is that, you know, we create these things, these laws, these approaches like Jeff Sessions for that boogeyman, right? But the freedoms that it ends up eroding are not the boogeyman's freedoms necessarily. It's all of us. So I think we have to ask ourselves, how do we want to be policed in this country? Not it's a black problem, it's a South Side problem. How do we? Because that thing, that method, that's South, it's going to come North one day,
yeah.
and it's going to come other directions away. And I think this is a critical time to ask that question.
Lee Bay, Carol Felsenthal, we'll take our last break. We'll come back. We'll decide which stories will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 5,500 years from this week. What's it going to be? We'll find out here on The Download. Stay with us. Coming up tonight on The Download, Jean-Michel Jarre, considered to be the father of electronic music, French composer, held the Guinness Book World Record for largest show audience for a long time. He would do these huge amphitheater shows in Europe, and he was a composer who had figured out that the music was spectacle. And so he's the one who added the lights and the light shows to the music, and really is the father of the electronic EDM movement as we know it. He's going to be at the Auditorium Theater on Monday, and so he's joining us tonight. Also, Steve Gadlin will be here as well for The Frying Pan coming up at 10 o'clock. One of the underreported stories 847 is saying is the dropping of the rape charges of Julian Assange by the Swedish government. Very interesting, right? That, I mean, that was something that we heard.
Came today, though, right?
Yeah.
It's a new story.
It's new. It still makes it into the week wrap-up, right? That's right. That is an interesting one. Someone said as well, funny thing, nobody's making fun of Trump's hair anymore because there's too much else going on. And then 708 says trains and buses need protection, too. iPhones are stolen, rapes, college girl was just beat up bad, leaving UIC on a train. So, Lee, maybe we do need the
You don't need soldiers with assault rifles to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So a lot more down here as well. Really just talking about a lot about Donald Trump and Russia. And then, of course, 773 says their nominated story for the year, the story we're going to remember in 100 years, will be the Turkish president and the bodyguards beating up protesters on U.S. soil in Washington, D.C. this week. That's a great story.
And facing no consequences. You know, the State Department put out a statement, but it was a really mild statement of regret that it happened.
Right. All right, let's get to it. Which story are we going to remember from this week in 5 months, a year, 5 years, 10 years, 50 years, 500 years? When we blow up this planet and we're back to being cave dwellers, what are the stories that'll be written on the cave wall from this week's news? Why don't we start with you, Lee?
It'll be five letters, Trump, right? Scratched into the wall and with an underline on it. I think
this is the beginning?
I think it could be. It could be if we're here in 500 years or 50 years. But I think that what's happening this week either is noteworthy, obviously is noteworthy on its face, or it's going to lead to a lot more noteworthy things coming up that we are going to be talking about in the next 5, 10 years.
What do you got, Carol?
I think that the reversal of the progressive policies of the Obama administration in the form of executive orders, signs it in that weird signature he has with the cameras on him, probably didn't even read the 2 pages that he's signing. But, you're talking about the EPA. You're talking about our air and our water and reversals. You're talking about criminal justice and reversals there. And the big one that really gets me is the immigration thing. We know that the people who come to our country as immigrants, my grandparents, but the people who come here as immigrants, we need them. We are lacking people. We don't have enough people to do these jobs. And Trump, his wall will not get built, but he's built a virtual wall because a number of illegal entries are dropping very, very quickly. So he's got, well, I don't know what it is, 40% fewer immigrants coming across, but it's going to be,
there'll be
a
some
negative for
that,
our country
yeah.
and not a positive. And that's going to linger no matter who's elected next time.
My story that'll be remembered will be the Sun-Times. I think that the idea they put it up this week, and I think that it looks like the Tribune is going to be the one who purchases the Sun-Times.
Unless you call Jeff Bezos and tell
Yeah, right.
I got to order some groceries from Amazon Prime, Amazon Fresh tonight. I'll put a little note in there. Please buy sometimes.
I think that that's the story that will be remembered, especially if this becomes a one newspaper town because of it from this week. Lee Bay, Carol Felsenthal, I can't thank you guys enough. It was a great night tonight. And
thank
thanks
you.
For reloading this week's news with us here on WGN.
Thank you.
Thank you.